Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico.
Welcome back to the StarCast for the week of March 22nd, 2026. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Howdy, Mike.
Good morning, Jay.
Well, it's kind of, we've had a little bit of space weather over the last few days. What's going on? What's it looking like for the next couple days?
Yeah, Jay, we've got four sunspots that are facing the Earth today, but they all have stable magnetic fields with a very low chance of further activity. No estimates, 10% chance of M-class flares and a 1% chance of X-class flares over the next 48 hours. However, there's an active geomagnetic storm happening as we record this from a CME that erupted last week. There were actually two CMEs last week. Our planetary KP index is currently at 6.67. And I've caught a little bit of aurora in my time lapse over the last two nights. So here at mid-latitudes, we still have a 40% chance of a minor geomagnetic storm today, dropping to 30% tomorrow. But at high latitudes, the chance of a severe storm is 80% today and dropping to 65% tomorrow. So what's happening in the night sky this week, Jay?
Yeah, just briefly, could you explain the KP index to our viewers, what the scale is, and what is a 6.6 on a KP index?
Right. So that scale is how we determine what the level of activity is, and I'm not really prepared for that question. So I will say that the range is that a KP less than 5 is nothing. When we get to 5, we have a G1 storm. When we get to 6, we have a G2 storm. 7 is a G3 storm. 8 and 9 are a G4 storm. And if we get above 9, we're calling that a G5. There is also the HP30 index. So the K index gets updated every 3 hours, and the HP30 is updated every 30 minutes. And so if you're watching and waiting for an event, I think HP30 is sometimes going to give you a little bit more of a heads up. You know, it's a cold winter night, and I don't want to stand out in, minus 10 degrees hoping. So I look at HP30 and say, oh, now it's ticking up, and now we're up at a 5. It's time to go look.
Okay. Yeah. I think you did it for me surprising you. You did a remarkably great job explaining that and clarified it to me. So anyway, last week we had the new moon, an equinox, a geomagnetic storm, and a meteorite fall or two. So it's going to be tough to top that this week. Over the last couple evenings, just after dark, we've been seeing a spectacular crescent moon and Venus together. And over the next week, as we go toward the first quarter moon, the moon will be getting brighter and setting later each evening. So tonight and tomorrow night, March 22nd and 23rd, the waxing crescent moon will lie near the famous Pleiades star cluster, and also known as the Seven Sisters. And the Pleiades star cluster is in the constellation Taurus, the Bull, and its brightest star, Aldebaran, will be nearby. Also tonight, the moon will reach its perigee, its closest point to us, in its elliptical orbit around Earth at 12 UTC on March 22nd, 2026, that it will be 227,954 miles away from Earth, and for the rest of the world, that is 366,857 kilometers. Then on the evening of March 24th, the thick waxing crescent moon will lie near Jupiter and among some of our brightest stars. There are Kepler, Capella, Betelgeuse, and Aldebaran. So the 25th will be also the first quarter moon, and this month's moment of the first quarter moon will fall on 1918 Universal Time on March 25th, 2026. And that's about 2:18 p.m. Central Daylight Time. So the first quarter moon rises around noon on your local time, and then it sets around midnight. And then on the 26th, the now waxing gibbous moon will lie near bright Jupiter and the twin stars of Gemini, Castor and Pollux. So overall, it's good, it will be a good week to follow the moon. So Mike, we're covering quite a few news stories from last week. So what have you got for us in space news?
Yeah, Jay, you know, our topic last week was on detecting and preventing the impact of large asteroids on Earth, and it turned out to be pretty timely. A massive sonic boom rocked northeast Ohio and western Pennsylvania this past Tuesday morning, but it wasn't an earthquake or terrestrial explosion. NASA has confirmed that a 7-ton meteor, roughly 6 feet in diameter, screamed across the sky at 45,000 miles per hour. The space rock was first spotted over Lake Erie around 9 a.m. before it fragmented over Valley City, north of Medina. The breakup unleashed energy equivalent to 250 tons of TNT, creating a pressure wave that shook homes and prompted a flood of 911 calls from startled residents as far away as Virginia and Canada. The search for what's left of this visitor is already yielding results. Professional meteorite hunters and local residents have confirmed the recovery of several fragments in Medina County. One resident in the city of Medina discovered a small triangular black stone with a melted texture sitting right on her driveway, while a collector from Connecticut successfully tracked down two museum-quality specimens in the Sharon Center area. Experts say these black stones are likely achondrites, rare space rocks that are older than Earth itself. If you're in the area, NASA suggests looking in the strewn field stretching from Hinckley toward Rittman, but remember to look for rocks with a distinct coal black fusion crust. And then just yesterday in the Houston area, another meteorite streaked over the sky at about 35,000 miles per hour. This one was a little smaller. It only weighed 1 ton and with an estimated diameter of 3 feet. But it also created a pressure wave with large sonic booms that were reported. And this one, at least one fragment of it, actually hit a house and landed in the kitchen. There's a photo that we'll include in our show notes showing the meteorite lying on the kitchen floor, approximately the size of a human hand. So... we've really got some meteorite activity this week. And, you know, I thought we should just mention again the importance of contributing meteorite recovery to museums and educational institutes. They can be sold on the market, but they do are scientific community a great service when they are actually donated.
Yeah, and the temptation, of course, would be to try to profit from your good fortune, and if you're a meteorite hunter or a scientist, is that it's kind of the ethical thing to do is to turn that over to an educational institution rather than just put it onto the private market as like eBay or something like that. And the main thing to remember when you look for a meteorite is kind of, we call it the charcoal briquette look. And so if you look at enough meteorites, they kind of are similar to a charcoal briquette.
That's right. I've yet to find one myself, but, I'm always keeping my eye open.
Mm-hmm. One can only hope.
So, in other news, we have officially entered a new era of the space age. SpaceX has just crossed a staggering milestone. As of this week, there are now more than 10,000 Starlink satellites orbiting the Earth. If we were to go back 6 years ago, there were only 2,000 satellites total. And we now have five times that number just from Starlink, not counting the 2,000 that were already up there and the ones that have been launched by other companies and governments since then. So what started with a single launch back in 2019 has turned into a almost daily routine, sometimes more than once a day, with back-to-back launches from California and Florida pushing the constellation into five digits. While these satellites are providing high-speed internet to the most remote corners of the globe, the sheer volume of hardware overhead is changing the way that we look at the night sky, creating those trains of light that many onlookers mistake for UFOs. This orbital crowding comes with a growing set of concerns for scientists. Astronomers warn that the massive fleet is interfering with both visual and radio telescopes, and environmental researchers are worried about what happens when these satellites die. Roughly 1 to 2 Starlinks drop out of orbit every single day, burning up in the atmosphere and releasing metallic oxides that could potentially damage the Earth's protective ozone layer and maybe alter the geomagnetic field itself. With SpaceX planning to eventually triple this number to 30,000 satellites, experts are keeping a close watch on the so-called Kessler syndrome, a theorized chain reaction of collisions that could one day make the Earth's orbit a graveyard of debris.
So, yeah, this is, at first when they were appearing, it was kind of a novelty, and then it's just it's really devolved into a series of unintended consequences. I think that where we're finding that maybe the benefits do not outweigh the consequences.
That's right, and unfortunately, it's not just SpaceX. We have Amazon and other companies and other countries. China has put up their own GPS constellation and is probably going to be putting up internet in low Earth orbit as well. And so SpaceX is having to make daily and continuous adjustments to their satellites to avoid collisions. And we're only going to see that increase.
Yeah. And I just want to mention that, Dark Sky International in particular is one of the people, one of the organizations that's advocating that we putting the million plus satellites in orbit that SpaceX is proposing for their orbital servers. I forget exactly.
Yeah, the AI data centers, right? And
right.
It's unclear just how feasible that is. There's a huge problem with cooling. You have convection, conduction, and radiation. That's how heat is transferred. And in space, there is no convection or conduction. It's all radiation. And so you need a large surface area to dissipate the heat that the GPUs are generating. And so it becomes a problem of you've got to send up a large cooling radiator that can dissipate that heat, and that adds to weight, it adds to size. So it's not at all clear to me that there is a very, the strongest case is that you can have, maybe nonstop solar power powering it. So from an energy perspective, maybe, but from every other perspective, it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. And the idea that we're going to have a million of them up there, I don't know.
Yeah. And so people can, go to Dark Sky International, and there's a survey there. A petition.
Yes.
a petition for the public comment on that the FAA approving that and the FCC approving that million satellite data center project. And I know that both you and I are involved in dark sky advocacy, and so let's talk today about astronomy and science projects that you and I are personally doing. So, Mike, I hear that you added a new instrument to your home observatory. Can you tell us a bit about your new all-sky camera and some of the other stuff that you're working on and involved in?
Sure thing, Jay. Yeah, maybe a quick update. Last night, the Crestone Dark Sky Foundation held the first star party of 2026, and we had a great turnout for, a very small town. There were at least 35 people that showed up despite a few clouds, and we had a really nice evening. It was unusually warm, barely needed a coat. As part of the Crestone Dark Sky Foundation, I have a sky quality meter, which I ordered from Unihedron last year. And that is mounted right now on my roof. It points straight up and it takes readings of the sky brightness continuously. And this is used for long-term tracking of the conditions here in our town, which is a designated international dark sky community. Now, I have been investigating ways to archive and publish this SQM reading, and I found a piece of software that looked like it was going to be a nice web interface. And I noticed that the software supported all sky image in conjunction with the reading. So you might look and see we were at a 21.8 at 3 a.m. and here is the image that was taken at that time. And so I set about to start building the first all sky camera that I would operate on a permanent basis. I know you've had one for several years and it's kind of always been on my priority, lower on my priorities when it comes to having the money to invest in this. But I decided that it was time. So I picked up an ZWO ASI 676, which is marketed as an all-sky camera. It has about a 150-degree circular fisheye lens. I'd like 180, and I may replace that lens. But for now, I'm going to start out with the 150. And the software that, there's a number of different projects out there, the TJ's All Sky and Indie All Sky, that's INDI, which refers to the camera drivers. And I'm particularly interested in the amount of information that I can integrate with the Indie All Sky software. So, first of all, exporting those images so that they show up with my SQM data. And because, sometimes you're looking at the readings and it's like, well, here's a night where it was up and down and up and down. And you look at the images and you say, oh, that's because there was a cloud bank that moved in and moved out and then another one that moved in. And so this was just clouds rather than, actual human light pollution, although often clouds are reflecting that light pollution. But with the Indie All Sky, I can additionally track a number of other things. I have a weather station, so I can incorporate weather station data into the image itself. It will track the ISS and other satellites in orbit. It can connect with my ADS-B receiver to track airplanes and display data about what flights are overhead. As well as, what time sunrise, sunset, moonrise, moonset, and planets, which planets are visible currently in the sky, to name just some of the features that this Indie All Sky software has. So I'm waiting right now for a upgraded Raspberry Pi that is going to do the processing of images to get good time lapses out of this thing. My 2 gig model is insufficient. So I ordered a Pi 5 with 16 gigs, which is the most memory you can get on a Raspberry Pi. And I'm expecting that to arrive tomorrow. And then it comes to building a waterproof enclosure, getting it mounted up on the peak of my cupola, and getting power up there.
Yeah, and so, you mentioned the ADS-B, and could you explain what that is to our listeners a little bit?
Every aircraft is equipped with a transmitter that is continually broadcasting altitude, heading speed, some basic information. And so there are sites like flightaware.com, flightradar24.com, and others that have networks of people who host a antenna on their roof and gather that data from the ADS-B receivers. And that's how, if you go to flightradar24.com, you can see what airplanes are flying overhead at any given moment. And not just airplanes, balloons, helicopters, and other, not so much rockets, as far as I know, but the Goodyear blimp. I pay a lot of attention, in particular, to the high altitude balloons. That's one of the things that I'm very interested in tracking. And I will just say this, Jay, that I differentiating, satellites and airplanes from meteors is a skill that I've, developed over a lot of years. But I'm also, somewhat interested in tracking the persistent contrails left by airplanes during the daytime in the spirit of community education. I can tell you at our star party last night, I heard a couple of people talk about all the chemtrails that were up there. And I don't spend a lot of time arguing because I recognize that I'm more likely to, cause someone to dig in their heels on this particular topic, but I am interested in being able to document the weather conditions and the types of flights that are creating persistent contrails, for my own benefit and then for the benefit of people who might be in the undecided camp.
Yeah, and that kind of brings me to, I was going to bring this up in our discussion of why we do this, is, so why do you spend the money and the time and the headache of configuring software and staying up at night and making these time lapses and doing all these things, doing all these science projects?
Yeah, I will say the longer I do this, the all night time lapses, the more skeptical I become that there are regular extraterrestrial crafts flying over the San Luis Valley. I mean, we live in a so-called hotspot, and some of my neighbors tell me that they see orbs every night. And, it starts to I start to question, are the realities that we are living in, because my cameras don't record anything of that sort. I can generally identify this is an airplane. It has standard airplane configuration of lights. Sometimes it's low enough I can see, the fuselage and the wings. Or this is a satellite, or this is probably a satellite, but if it's not, it is just a dot of light far, far, far up in the atmosphere or in orbit, and not enough to get excited and make any claim about extraterrestrial activity. So, both of us, we've both been doing this for a long time. I'm going on at least 15 years of almost every night time lapses in multiple different states, but a lot of it here in the San Luis Valley. And I know you have too. And I mean, I'd be really excited and really genuinely pleased to record something that was, indisputably of extraterrestrial origin. I'm not opposed to that happening, or I don't believe it's impossible, but night after night, week after week, year after year, and I'm not seeing things that I can't explain. And it's not a matter of, oh, they're invisible to me. They're invisible to my cameras. So.
Yeah. And yeah, being a quote unquote skeptic is that, and I really don't look at it that way. I look at it as being a person of science, is that science is about show me, is that I'm not going to say that you're wrong, but show me, show me that I'm wrong, or and so that's one of the things that is certainly a motivator for me.
That's right, and I will say also, I've discovered that there are new phenomena that I was not previously familiar with. Probably the first big one were the red sprites. And that was somewhat new to science as a whole in the 90s. And then, things such as the Steve and the SAR arcs, some of the rocket leaving trails of exhaust that, create these very stunning displays, that are initially like, oh, maybe this is something something really extraordinary happening. And it is extraordinary, but extraordinary doesn't always mean extraterrestrial. And it usually turns out that there is, the SpaceX auroras, right? The holes in the ionosphere. Another really good example of something that if you don't know what you're seeing, it can be pretty mysterious. I mean, there's a glowing orb. They're not happening every night, but they're happening, a few times a month or so.
And you've been very helpful to me, and kind of bouncing back and forth between you and I. It's been a good educational process. I mean, I wouldn't have known about gravity waves or the difference between air glow and sky glow, for example, had we not been doing these time lapses and these projects. And so let's talk a little bit about some of my projects, if we've got some time here. And so, so you mentioned that I'd had an all sky camera for quite a while, and this was the original software, which was from Thomas Joaquin, and it's called TJ's All Sky software. And I was running that with a Raspberry Pi HQ camera with a 180 degree lens, and that works pretty good. And actually, through my not doing proper weather sealing and other factors, snowstorms and blowing the camera off of the pole and things like that, as I've gone through now probably three cameras. And so I'm awaiting the delivery of my fourth camera tomorrow, or probably be tomorrow or Tuesday, and so that I can get that back up and operating. And so you kind of inspired me. I'd played around with Indy AllSky before, and instead of TJ's, and I was just because it was kind of resource heavy, and it took a lot of configuration, and I'd already had the TJ AllSky set up. I would just kind of push the easy button, stayed with TJ. But this week I decided to go ahead and upgrade to Indy AllSky, since you were doing that as well, and unfortunately, trying to install that over the TJ AllSky software on my Raspberry Pi did not work. I spent about 2 full days trying to get that to work and tracking down bugs and errors. And then finally on Friday, I just decided to wipe the SD card and install it from the ground up with the OS and everything. And so that's hopefully going to be up and running at about the same time as yours. And so we'll both be contributing that Indy AllSky information. So in addition to that, is I have what I call my Meteor cams. And these are basically security cameras, basic IP security cameras. And so I have one that's facing to the north And that is a monochrome camera with a field of view of about 90 degrees width and 45 degrees in height. And that is running the Global Media Network software. And so that records every night as a monochrome time lapse. And it also does some real-time capture of events. It does about a 10-second movie every 10 seconds, and records all that information, and then the software processes that information, and it can actually tries to separate. It knows what the star chart is, and so it uses plate solving and eliminates stars. And it tries to eliminate aircraft and satellites from the image, and so that they do a final captured image of just meteors. And so there, the Global Media Network, it was founded in, I know we're starting to run long here, but it was founded in Europe and deployed, and where they deployed a lot of these cameras. And kind of everybody's deploying the same camera and the same software and forming this network. And the idea was that by having a grid there, they could do triangulation and tracking of meteors. And they migrated that to America, and New Mexico in particular, and the University of New Mexico started up what is called the New Mexico Meteor Array. And so this is a series of these Global Meteor Network stations, and they're set up as a network and at various locations facing various directions. And whenever there's a meteor detected, is that it's triangulated between this array, and so they can do a really good job of tracking meteors. And so that's one project that I'm involved with. And then another is, so then I have the three other just off-the-shelf IP cameras, one facing east, south, and west. And so those record every night, all night, in color. And so if there's actually a meteor that reported, is I can go back and track down on those cameras within their field, and if there's a meteor in their field of view, I can actually get a real-time capture of that meteor. And so that's pretty exciting. And then some of the organizations I'm involved with is our local astronomy club, which is called the El Valier Astronomers Club, which refers to the Rio Grande Valley. And when they just had a star party last night that I did not attend, I was at another event. And so that's one of the things I'm involved with. And I'm becoming their webmaster right now and putting up their website. And then also we've got Dark Sky International. I'm involved with that. And then we've also got Dark Sky Week coming up in April. And it's actually Dark Sky Month, but they're having a special Dark Sky Week, and I believe that's I have to remember the date. I think it's April 11th through 20th, so there's a couple events that we're having here in Taos, and one of those events is a art show highlighting astrophotography, and I'll be showing my time lapses and a couple of my astrophotographs at that show. And that's an educational opportunity as well. And then, finally, you didn't kind of mention auroras as one of the things that, the reasons that we do this. And I call it aurora fishing. Is that, we put out the time lapses every night, and it's like, well, maybe this night we'll catch an aurora. And it's just kind of like fishing, is that, there's almost there's the fun of fishing, and then there's the fun of catching fish. And so, those are both integrated in our time lapses. And of course, and I have to mention this, is this podcast is that, you know, I spend at least a few hours a week preparing for it. And of course, then we spend this time recording and publishing it. So yeah, that's we kind of are going a little bit long today, but you know, I thought that was an interesting discussion.
It sure was. Thanks, Jay.
Okay, well, we hope that all of our listeners found that as interesting as we did, and we thank you for checking out the podcast. And please be sure to comment, like, and subscribe. We'd love to hear your feedback. We don't get enough. Let us know what you'd like to hear more about. And you can also check out our websites, and Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com, and mine is skylapser.com, and of course our YouTube channels, and don't forget to look at those. I know Mike put up a bunch of time lapses this week, so did I, and so it's always fun to look at. And our intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. And from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky
wishing you all clear skies.